First of all, I would like to thank Johanna and Ulrika for this invitation, and I also think that it is actually great to have a conference on the Thinking Revolution in a university where there is an occupation, a student's occupation going on in defense of public free and public education. And I must also say that I this is a topic I feel particularly close to me, also because I would not be here giving this talk if it were not for the what it was once, the free public education system in Italy. And what is happening here is probably what happened in Italy in the last 20 years, and the outcome was a consistent drop in working class students from a working class background going to university in Italy. So I really want to express my support to the attempt to block this kind of process, cuts to the education here. So I'm not going really to talk about revolution specifically, although I will talk about what I think is a relevant topic for from the viewpoint of rethinking revolution, which is that of universality from a feminist perspective. And one of the reasons, which may be a contentious reason, why I want to talk about universality is that I think that there is a very strong bond link, both historically and from a political theoretical viewpoint, between revolutionary processes and forms of articulation of universality or universalistic politics. So I think what I'm going to suggest today is that I think that from a feminist perspective, we should actually reclaim a certain form of universality, and I will argue for this. I must also say that this is an embryonic project. In other words, this is still a work in progress, and it's the first time that I actually not only write on this specific topic, but I present this topic. So I will be really grateful to you for the discussion, because this will probably help me articulating further what my argument, my claims, and so on. In a moving piece titled The Mastery of Non-Mastery, Mick Taussig recounts his travel to a Kobani devastated by ISIS forces. He reports a conversation with women combatants in the women's house, and he quotes the following words. I quote, "It was so terrible. It was not only we who were fighting, but the whole world was with us. I cannot tell you what happened, but I can tell you we were connected to each other and to the land, which is the land of humanity." End of quote. Humanity is what is at stake, at least in this conversation with Taussig, for the women combatants who spoke to him, not only in the struggle with ISIS forces, but also in their attempt to create a democratic, ecological, and feminist society without the borders of a nation state. For Kobani, does not belong to Kobani people alone. Welcome, this town is yours. It belongs to humanity. We make life, that's how we are able to go on. This is how Taussig and his colleagues were welcomed when they arrived there. Faced with a large body of feminist theoretical work criticizing universality and universalistic politics, what shall we make of this appeal to universal humanity, to a universal connection of everybody with everybody else, to a shared destiny, a shared land, the land of humanity, to a new democratic horizontal social organization for everyone to take part in? An appeal made specifically by feminist combatants who want to liberate themselves in order to set everybody else free. The feminist problem with universality is an old one, at least as old as Olympe de Gouges' 1791 Declaration of the Rights of Women Citizens. However, I think, as I said at the beginning, that there are good reasons to come back to this very old theoretical debate and political debate. And these reasons are, for me, first of all, of a political nature. After some decades in which the imperatives of difference, particularity, and localism have been largely supported as the political antidote to the large and exclusionary meta-narratives characterizing modern politics, we are now confronted, in my view, with a major question, especially if we think about what we will discuss later about ecological destruction, and if we think about the last decades of neoliberal policies. Is a politics of transformation of social relations, and more specifically, is a politics aimed at overcoming heterosexist and racist capitalism and striving at a truly democratic, free and egalitarian society, concretely possible without the articulation of some form of universality and universal claims and demands? This question is all the more urgent today, for as feminists, in a sense, we have lost our innocence. Confronted with the increasing capacity of neoliberalism and nationalism to both co-opt and instrumentalize some of the ideas and claims articulated within feminist theory and within women's movements, we cannot elude the necessity to radically rethink some tenets of feminist discourse over the last decades. In fact, as I will argue in this paper, insofar as the capitalist world is indeed a world, and it is not a merely contingent patchwork of disjointed fragments, the notion of universality should not be evicted from a politics of transformation. Not only should it not because of reasons of political effectiveness, but it should not because we are always already entangled in the universality historically produced by capitalist social relations, as well as in the discourse of universality articulated within modernity. The question we should ask, therefore, is not so much how to articulate a feminist politics without recurring to universals of any kind, but rather what kind of universality we need politically if the aim we have is that of a radical transformation of social relations and, from a feminist perspective, the end of heterosexist oppression. So in this paper, I would like to start clarifying the different ways in which we can think about universality. I would like to adopt a distinction made by Etienne Balibar in his essay Ambiguous Universality between three viewpoints on universality. And I will not only adopt this distinction to actually enlighten some aspects concerning the reality of gender under capitalism on the one hand, but also some stakes of feminist and gender politics on the other. Now, the first viewpoint on universality identified by Balibar is that what he calls universality as reality. This indicates the actual interdependency between the various units that build what we call the world. This interdependency should be understood as both extensive and intensive. On the one hand, it reaches all parts of the world. On the other hand, it increasingly invests more aspects of the life of the constitutive units. The second viewpoint identified by Balibar is that what he calls fictive universality, in the sense of a universality historically constructed through institutions and representations, such, for example, as the national political universality or religious universality. This universality, writes Balibar, transcends the limitations and qualifications of particular identities and memberships, and virtually deconstructs and reconstructs primary identities, addressing the members of primary memberships as individuals and relativizing their particularities. Balibar notes that this fictive universality, while it has historically been an effective means of integration to a certain extent, as it leads, I quote, dominated groups to struggle against discrimination or inequality in the very name of the superior values of the community, It has also normality as a prerequisite. The counterpart, so the negative aspect of this fictive universality, is normalization, as the subjectivity this universality requires and develops is one that is compatible with normality. Now, I will use in this paper these two notions of universality, so real and fictive, in order to enlighten some aspects relative to gender under capitalism. And these are not the two notions I want to adopt as a political claim. The third viewpoint identified by Balibar is what he calls universality as symbol, or ideal universality, existing, I quote, in the form of absolute or infinite claims which are symbolically raised against the limits of any institution. This universality is linked with the notion of insurrection or insurgency. It introduces the notion of the unconditional into the realm of politics. It actively abolishes discrimination in the name of the inseparability of liberty and equality. It goes beyond any institutional citizenship. It has an intersubjective or trans-individual character, and it asserts the unconditional right to politics. So this is Balibar's definition of symbolic or ideal universality. Now, what I would like to do in this paper is actually to reclaim a version of this notion of universality as insurgence for feminism. This notion, in my view, does not hide, but rather radically integrates the aporetic nature of universality as a site of political conflict. What I mean by this is a notion of universality that does not rely either on an anthropological or an ontological foundation, for example, in a fixed and abstract definition of human nature, or of the common human essence, or on a foundation in a transcendentalist notion of human reason. For it sees both the human and reason as shaped by historical processes. This political notion of insurgent universality will therefore need to be characterized, in my view, by an open-ended process of transformation and contestation. Now, before I turn to my application of Balibar's three viewpoints on universality, or three accounts of different forms of universality, I would like to very briefly address the problem of the feminist critics of universality. And of course, what I'm going to say now is clearly not exhaustive and it's very simplistic, but for reasons of time, I will explain why what I think are the two main forms of critique within feminist theory addressed against universality. And I will also try to show how often these critiques actually in a way rely on implicit universal claims. The first kind of critique is the one that took place immediately in the wake of the French Revolution and had as its kernel the critique of false universality, that is, of supposedly universal claims which were actually based on the systematic exclusion of women in the name of a more comprehensive one. This is, I take to be the gesture of Olympe de Gouges. So reclaiming universality, but denouncing the way in which universality is articulated within the French Revolution with the exclusion of women. And we could see the same kind of process also in the experience of Black Jacobins in Haiti. So it's a reappropriation of universality, but in the name, of universality capable of actually comprehending really everybody, not excluding some. Now, this form of critique does not challenge the notion of universality as such, but rather its concrete political expression at various points of history. Now, the second strand of feminist critique of universality is the one that actually questions the very notion of universality, emphasizing the exclusionary aspect of any universality and focusing on the genealogy of the concept as revealing its maleness and ethnocentric Western bias. This critique challenges both the epistemological presuppositions behind the discourse of universality, as well as its ontological and anthropological presuppositions, by denying the possibility of actually defining a human essence and denouncing the political exclusionary character of any attempt at such a definition. The second strand of critique has led to at least two different political theoretical conclusions. One is a refusal of universalistic politics as such, in the name of a politics of difference, particularity, and localism, where alliances, if there are any, can overlap only in the way of a merely contingent patchwork. The other is rather a problematization of universality, leaving open the possibility of the concept of universality, leaving open the possibility for a constant political rearticulation of universality. For example, in her two articles, Contingent Foundations and For a Careful Reading, Judith Butler, after stressing the exclusionary character of any notion of comprehensive universality and noticing how cultural conflicts can, to an extent, be understood as clashes between different sets of presumed and intransigent universalities, concludes not that we should abandon universal claims altogether, but rather that we should leave universality permanently open, contested, and contingent, and that we should provoke its radical rearticulation. And what I'm going to do in this paper is something along these lines, but with the difference that will appear clear in the rest of the paper. Now, a simplified version of the story of these two forms of critique may be that while first wave feminism was still bound to the universalistic ideals coming from Enlightenment and the French Revolution, and preach full inclusion of women, second wave and third wave feminism operated a significant break with this legacy. This simplified version of the story, however, runs the risk of missing a crucial point, namely the fact that, as noted by Jody Dean, in its various versions, feminism has often implicitly or explicitly relied either on universal claims or on universal demands. Jody Dean, for example, notes that second-wave feminism, or at least some strands of second-wave feminism, in exploring and articulating women's experiences, de facto reinstated the universality, but in the particularist guise of the feminine, so the universal feminine. Precisely for this reason, the same gesture of contestation of false exclusionary universality that took place during the French Revolution was repeated within second-wave feminists by sectors of women, for example, black feminists, whose specific experiences of oppression or whose identities were excluded by the new universal feminine. In this case, too, this critique against false universality led to different political theoretical conclusions, not all of which entailed a straightforward refusal of universalist claims or of unity in political solidarity. Moreover, as noted by Jody Dean, third-wave post-structuralist feminist rebuttal of universal categories, by calling upon our responsibility toward the non-identical and criticizing the systematic exclusion produced by universal categories, implicitly rely on the normative force of an ideal of inclusion, which could be considered as actually an universal ideal or a universal claim, like a right to an universal right to inclusion. Now, I'm going to give you just a couple of examples of how these critics often combine, actually, not with with the straightforward refusal of universality, but with an implicit, or in some cases, explicit adoption of some form of universalism or universality. One is from black feminist thought. Patricia Collins, in her presentation of what are, according to her, the distinguishing features of black feminist thought, writes that, I quote, U.S. black feminist thought and practice respond to a fundamental contradiction of U.S. society. On the one hand, democratic promises of individual freedom, equality under the law, and social justice are made to all American citizens. Yet, on the other hand, the reality of differential group treatment based on race, class, gender, sexuality, and citizenship status persists, end of quote. But is Collins' conclusion that ideals of equality and freedom are a fraud in their own right? This would not seem to be the case, as Collins, quoting immediately after, quoting Crenshaw's work on the limitations of juridical equality and color blindness, continues by noting that the problem with abstract equality is precisely that it helps generate inequality. So that the point seems not so much that we should oppose difference to equality, but rather that we should oppose a form of equality which takes difference into account and radically integrates it to another form of equality, which in its entirely abstract character reproduces differences as inequalities. A similar move is present in some post-structuralist feminism as well. John Scott, for example, explicitly questions the dichotomy between difference and equality by emphasizing that such a binary opposition demands from feminists an impossible choice. In fact, as Scott notes, the origins of egalitarianism did not abstract from differences in the sense of ignoring them, but rather were abolitionist in the sense of actively negating a particular set of differences for the purpose of making democratic citizenship possible. As such, this early egalitarianism actually entails or should entail the acknowledgement of differences, of actual differences. So I quote, this is from Only Paradoxes to Offer, placing equality and difference in antithetical relationship has then a double effect. It denies the way in which difference has long figured in political notions of equality, and it suggests that sameness is the only ground on which equality can be claimed. It thus puts feminists in an impossible position. For as long as we argue within the terms of a discourse set up by this opposition, we grant the current conservative premise that because women cannot be identical to men in all respects, we cannot expect to be equal to them. The only alternative, it seems to me, is to refuse to oppose equality to difference and insist continually on differences as the condition of individual and collective identities. Differences as the constant challenge to the fixing of those identities. History as the repeated illustration of the play of differences. And differences as the very meaning of equality itself, end of quote. These examples and this very brief, unfair discussion of the feminist debate over universality does not by any means intend to be exhaustive, but its purpose is rather to show that whatever suspicions one may have toward universalistic claims and the Enlightenment, the project of entirely disentangling feminist thought and politics from universalistic claims of some sort appears to be rather problematic. By this, I do not intend to claim that the dichotomy between universality and the recognition of differences exists only in the mind of the critics of universalistic politics. On the contrary, it is, in my view, a reflection of and a reaction to one of the possible articulations of universality, and it's a reaction to one of the ways in which universality has been historically articulated. But this articulation of universality, which in the last instance equates, in my view, to a normalization of the originary insurgent content of universality, should be challenged as such, that is, not as universality per se, but rather as only one of the historical forms that universality took. So in order to be able to do so, however, we need to make explicit, or start making explicit, and articulate the kind of insurgent universality we can oppose to the other historical trajectory of universality, the one entailing normalization and exclusion. Now, before proceeding on this notion of insurgent universality, and turning again to Balibar's distinction, I would like to very briefly, once again, address the issue of humanism. As I have argued above, the notion of insurgent universality I intend to defend dispenses with foundations in a definition of human nature or essence, as well as clearly in a definition of women's nature. Now, I clearly don't have the time here to address in depth the still ongoing debate over humanism, for example, within Marxist theory. However, I would like to at least address a possible objection to the idea that a universalistic project does not need to be based on a notion of human essence. Recently, Nancy Holmstrom has argued that a theory of human nature is necessary and politically important to feminists, first because certain presumptions about human nature motivate or discourage people about possible political change, and second, because rooting a politics of radical change in an idea of invariant human needs and capabilities allows feminists who fight for women's emancipation to resist the charge of utopianism. Now, what I'm going to do now is to address the first point, that about political motivation, then to offer an alternative way of rooting a transformative politics which doesn't refer to a definition of human essence. Now, on the first point, I think it is important to make a crucial distinction. The ideal of the practical realization of humanity or of human self-fulfillment, the demand for more humane conditions of life or of work, or for more humane social and interpersonal relations, asserting one's own belonging to humanity, whether as an individual or as a discriminated and oppressed group, are certainly powerful mobilizing claims. And they have historically undergirded, in a way or in another, social and revolutionary movements. So there is some truth to what Nancy Holmstrom says. But whether these claims were rooted in or reflected a specific and fully articulated notion of human nature, and of what delimits the human, and especially whether their political effectiveness and mobilizing power were due to the coherence and cogency of a specific theory of human nature, is an altogether different matter. In fact, this is my hypothesis, it may be precisely the indeterminacy of these statements, their negative character, consisting of the negation or abolition of discrimination, hierarchy, exploitation, and inequality, that confers them both political force and openness to resignification, renegotiation, and transformation. In other words, this indeterminacy maintains an open political space for new processes of subjectivation, for new insurgencies that may be bearers of an unprecedented viewpoint on needs, desires, capabilities, and their oppression or exploitation. To really simplify, I quoted at the beginning Kobani's combatant women appealing to humanity or to the idea of the land of humanity and so on. But my bet would be that if we ask them, or if you ask people in Kobani to actually what they mean by humanity or what is the definition of a human being and humanity, I'm not so sure that what we would get is the same definition from all the people involved in the same struggle. And probably what we would get is actually a multiplicity of viewpoints on what humanity and human beings are. So what I'm trying to suggest is that the political effectiveness or the mobilizing power of this kind of the appeal of this kind of claims may actually lie precisely in the fact that they are indeterminate. So they express more of an aspiration or an ideal aspiration than an actual coherent belief or a definition of what human beings are. Now, the approach I'm suggesting seems to be, to me at least, I know this is another contentious point, and clearly Marxist humanists would completely disagree with me, but I think that the approach I'm suggesting is more coherent with Marx's own view on human nature in his famous sixth thesis on Feuerbach than attempts at defining, for example, a minimal invariant human nature. Marx famously writes that the human essence is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. This is a quotation, sorry. In its reality, it is the ensemble of the social relations. Feuerbach, who does not enter upon a criticism of this real essence, is consequently compelled to abstract from the historical process and to fix the religious sentiment as something by itself and to presuppose an abstract, isolated human individual. Essence, therefore, in Feuerbach's framework, can be comprehended only as genus, as an internal dumb generality which naturally unites the many individuals, end of quote. As noted by Althusser, the identification of a human wesen with the ensemble of social relations undermines the very notion of an essence, insofar as a theory of social relations refers in Marx to human beings' continuous self-transformation through their relations with others and their practice. This would entail that being human cannot be posited as a starting point, a presupposition or a foundation for as freedom and equality. It is rather a site of political struggle and something that the contours of which we cannot really know in advance. So let me now turn to Balibar's notion of universality as reality. This notion allows me to address the potential danger contained in an idea of political insurgent universality without foundation and in a politics of solidarity and alliances based on it. So this addresses the second of Nancy Olmstrom's point, which is that we need some kind of definition of human nature in order not to appear utopian. And actually addresses a real problem, which is that if we want to support a merely political idea of universality or form of universality, clearly there is a problem with the risk of voluntarism. So basically with the idea that this appeal to universality then equates to an appeal to people to be nice to each other, or to be in solidarity with each other. And one may ask, why should they do it at all? Now, in order to address this danger, that of sounding just either voluntaristic or utopian, I intend to argue for the fact that while without foundation, ontological foundation, this notion of universality is not arbitrary or voluntaristic either, as it is immanently and historically rooted in the fact that capitalist social relations of production have created a universality as reality. As such, political insurgent universality is rooted not in an invariant human essence or in a definition of human nature, but rather in the totalization effect, what I call the totalization effect historically produced by capitalist social relations and in its consequences. Now, there may be various ways to understand this totalization effect. So various ways to read in what sense the capitalism created a world, historically created a world. One way may consist of emphasizing homogenization of conditions and experiences across the globe produced by capitalist accumulation, the global market, commodification, neoliberal globalization, abstract labor, and the increasing commodification of all aspects of life. Then in this kind of view, this process of homogenization would be the real basis for universalistic revolutionary politics. Basically, we are becoming all more the same among each other, and this is the basis for universalistic politics. Or we are sharing similar experiences, and this is the basis for universalistic politics. Now, this is an approach to the problem at stake that has been starkly criticized by feminists concerned with the possible obliteration of the relevant differences in living experience, cultural legacy, racial identity, and social position that actually divide women. It is also an approach that I would like to carefully avoid, as the idea that capitalism homogenizes social conditions and living experience is simply empirically mistaken. Or better said, the actual existing elements of equalization need to be understood against the background of equally relevant processes of fragmentation and differentiation intimately linked to the logic of capitalist reproduction. Now, a second approach, alternative approach, may consist of arguing that sexual and gender oppression are a unified phenomenon across the globe, in that they are functional. They are all functional to the working of capitalist accumulation, or governed and organized by its logic. Now, this would be either because they provide a functional ideological justification for the hierarchical nature of the division of labor, or because they support a form of organizational social reproduction based on women's free labor, which would then be functional to the imperative of the pursuits of profits, or because of both. Now, the functionalist flavor of such an approach, however, already evidences what its theoretical impasses may be. First of all, this approach seems to assume that there is always already a perfect harmony and correspondence between capitalism needs, ideological constellations, and social phenomena of oppression and discrimination. Things, however, appear to be more complicated and contradictory than this. For at certain points of history or in certain regions, the persistence of patriarchal relations has been or may be an obstacle from the viewpoint of capitalist interest to an extent. For example, it may be at odds with the interest of one specific capitalist sector, but functional to another. Finally, while heterosexist ideology does play a useful role for the reproduction of a capitalist social order, what we have witnessed in the last years is actually a certain capacity compared to what the feminists believed, for example, in the 70s, a certain capacity by neoliberal capitalists to actually precisely absorb and co-opt some forms of feminist discourse and some versions of a discourse of sexual liberation. In fact, one may suggest that recent debates and civil victories about same-sex marriage precisely display the tension between two forms of universality identified by Balibar, fictive and ideal. And I'm saying this not because I'm not in support of same-sex marriage, but because I think there is a problematic aspect in a way that I will now quote, in which the right to same-sex marriage is articulated. Robert Kennedy's historical ruling about same-sex marriage in the US is perhaps exemplary of the relationship between fictive universality and normalization. For according to its logic, gay and lesbian people must be granted the right to marry in virtue of their individual right to liberty qua full members of the nation. This is precisely Balibar's point about the notion of the nation as linked and normalization as linked to this specific form of fictive universality. I will quote, to prove my point, I will quote a passage from Kennedy's ruling. The states have contributed to the fundamental character of the marriage right by placing that institution at the center of so many facets of the legal and social order, so the existing legal and social order. There is no difference between same and opposite sex couples with respect to this principle. Yet, by virtue of their exclusion from that institution, same-sex couples are denied the constellation of benefits that the states have linked to marriage. This harm results in more than just material burdens. Same-sex couples are consigned to an instability many opposite-sex couples would deem intolerable in their own lives. And the state itself makes marriage all the more precious by the significance it attaches to it. Exclusion from the state, exclusion from that status has the effect of teaching that gays and lesbians are unequal in important respects. It demeans gays and lesbians for the state to lock them out of a central institution of the nation's society. Same-sex couples, too, may aspire to the transcendent purposes of marriage and seek fulfillment in its highest meaning. So basically, what we have in this kind of logic, in the motivation, Kennedy's motivation for the ruling is precisely the idea that marriage as a fundamental tenet of the nation and of the state, and the right to same-sex marriage as a right that has to do precisely with the construction of, with the maintenance of the social order, existing social order, and with the of the nation. Of course, there are completely different ways in which one could articulate the right to same-sex marriage, which again I actually support. But it is significant the way in which this ruling articulates it, which I think it may be taken as an example of Balibar's point about fictive universality. Now, to go back to the problem of how to conceptualize real universality, so in what sense capitalism has created a world or has created a real universality, we should understand capitalism's totalizing effect in terms not of functionally, not in functionalist terms, not in terms of homogenization of conditions, but rather in terms of constraints. In other words, capitalist accumulation produces or contributes to the production of varying forms of social hierarchy and oppressions, including heterosexist oppression, as its necessary consequences. Moreover, and this is perhaps a more controversial claim, capitalist accumulation and capitalist reproduction are today what I consider to be the ultimate cause, so the driving force behind the reproduction of gender oppression, as patriarchy has long ago ceased to be a system moved by its own autonomous logic. So while various forms of oppression interact with each other or even grow together and cannot be phenomenically thought of without one another, capitalist accumulation poses necessitating constraints that determine to a large extent all other forms of social relations. Now, the fact that the logic of capitalist accumulation is pervasive is one of the grounds for speaking of the capitalist world as a contradictory and articulated moving totality. While phenomena of expropriation, of creation of a capitalist nature, of universalization of the wage form, of privatization and commodification of the activities, work, and bonds within the sphere of social reproduction may actually entail a certain degree of homogenization, these phenomena are also accompanied by the opposite tendency, that of the creation of social differences and new forms of inequality, and also different kinds of experience, so different ways in which this oppression and this exploitation is experienced concretely by people and by women. However, I take both sets of phenomena as consequences of the way capitalist accumulation unfolds. So in other words, what I'm trying to suggest is that capitalism produces both phenomena. On the one hand, there is a certain element of homogenization in the sense of the commodification aspects of life or of wage labor or being forced wage labor to survive, expropriation, and so on. But on the other hand, it also produces constantly the hierarchies, differences, different kinds of experiences within the same class. The global care chain is exemplary of this logic in that it entails both interdependency and hierarchical differentiation within the overall framework of the material constraints imposed by the capitalist organization of labor. As Yeats writes, recent research typically sees care chain as driven by a woman in a rich country entering paid employment and finding herself unable to fulfill her domestic duties of childcare and house cleaning without working a double day. In order to free herself from this double day, she purchases another woman's labor. This other woman tends to be drawn from a poorer household, either locally or increasingly from abroad. Often the woman from the poorer household is herself married with dependent children and has migrated to take up paid domestic labor. By doing this, she finds herself unable to discharge her own domestic duties because she's geographically distant from her children, creating a need for another woman to substitute for her. This other woman is often drawn from an even poorer household in the sending country, or she may be a member of the migrant woman's extended family. As we go down the chain, the value ascribed to the labor decreases and often becomes unpaid at the end of the chain. I quote this as an example of the way in which the same constraint on social reproduction, for example, posed by neoliberalism, in a sense, put women in the same situation of not being able to really fulfill, put women in a situation in which there is no social provision for social reproduction, so they have to solve the problem of how to perform social reproduction. So this unites these women, but at the same time also creates a hierarchy and differences by creating this chain in which a woman works for another woman and so on and so on. To sum up, and I'm concluding, understanding the capitalist world as a real universality from the viewpoint of gender does not entail presupposing a homogenization of conditions and experience or having a functionalist account of the way capitalism relates to gender and sexual oppression. In fact, equalization and the generation of inequalities and differences are both inherent phenomena of the mechanisms of capitalist reproduction. Now, this to conclude about my political claim for a political insurgent universality, of course, leave us with a problem. Because I argued that applying the notion of real universality to capitalism would help us to avoid reducing an ideal insurgent universality and a politics of alliances and solidarity coherent with it to a merely voluntaristic drive. So in what sense does the historically produced totalization I've just discussed offer a basis for insurgent universality? Now, it should by now be clear that contrary to the illusions cultivated at the beginning of the working class movement, there is no mechanical or automatic translation of one universality into another. So in other words, there is no automatic translation of what they call the real universality of capitalism in political insurgent universality. We are not on a train traveling toward universal liberation and equality. And actually, if I to express my pessimistic mood in these times, I think that irreversible ecological disaster is actually at the moment a much more likely possibility than a global revolution dispensing with capitalism once and for all, although I do think that we should still try. In fact, by connecting us into a world, capitalism has created only the historical possibility for a politics of insurgent universality, but not its historical necessity. Historical possibility, however, is all we need to articulate further what a politics of insurgent universality may be. The realization, so in other words, we should drop similar religious beliefs in the fact that we are, that somehow the overcoming of capitalism will somehow unfold from the nature of capitalism itself. The realization of this historical possibility requires, to use Daniel Ben Said's words, a return to the politico-strategic question. As differences, inequalities, and hierarchies produced and reproduced by capitalist social relations do create objective conflicts and of interest, contradictions, and difference of experience among those who are oppressed and exploited, a mere proliferation of fragments of struggle and processes of conflictual subjectivation alone will hardly give birth to a broad-scale effective alliances. But I want to insist that on the term politico-strategic, precisely because reclaiming the insurgent aspect of universality and its legacy for a project of liberation from sexism and sexual oppression confronts us with problems that are of a practical political nature and that cannot be solved in merely theoretical terms or by means of foundationalist theories. It requires, moreover, a radical openness to the emergence of multiple forms of subjectivation, bearing a different viewpoint of what unites and what divides us, and different levels and kinds of critique of capitalist social relations. Finally, it requires a profane, to quote again Ben Said, a profane approach to politics, an approach that has as a goal, rather than a utopian vision, and looks at what is beyond without cultivating the illusion of having already arrived there.